Life expectancy content is for informational and storytelling purposes only. We are not medical professionals, and nothing discussed in this episode or contained on the life expectancy website should be taken as medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you're facing medical concerns, addiction, or any health-related challenges, please seek guidance from a qualified medical professional or a licensed healthcare provider. Thank you for being a part of our journey, and we encourage you to seek support from trusted professionals when needed. Welcome to Life Expectancy, Sisters Surviving and Thriving.
Hi, welcome.
I'm Julie, and this is...
Stacy.
Today, we're going to dive into introducing ourselves and who we are to each other. Like all of you, we've had important moments that drive us to make decisions, and all decisions have consequences, both good and bad. We want to share a bit about how we got here, because it informs a bit of who we are now.
Yeah, I think history helps give insight and background into some of our motivations and just why we are the way we are.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's dive in. I think it's best to start, well, at the beginning.
Okay. So when I talk to people about my childhood, I grew up very suburban with a two-parent household. It was very typical. I played in the cul-de-sac with my friends, and both my parents worked full-time, and then we had dinner, and then that was it. And I had one very defining moment of my childhood, and I was 7 years old, and my 14-year-old sister, who also lived with me at the time, ran away.
That's me.
So I have this seven and before idyllic kind of childhood where I'm young and I don't have the best memory as it is. So like everything seems kind of shiny and pretty and everything's great. And then I have after that where Julie has left and people are arguing, but I don't exactly understand what's going on. And in my little bumbling brain, I really thought that you left. Mm-hmm. To be clear, she didn't run away. She didn't just leave. She chose to live with her father from her high school years on. So I didn't quite understand that. And I blamed myself as a seven-year-old kid. And then I came to kind of describe myself as an only child.
My time before Stacy with my mom and her dad, my stepdad, is very, very different. And then there's Stacy arriving, and then there was this event when I had to leave. So I would like to say I didn't want for anything. In other words, I had my grandparents, I had my parents.
Yeah, our grandparents were really involved.
They really were, and I spent a lot of time with them on both sides. But my mom and dad are divorced, and they got divorced when I was 3.5 years old, almost four. And I have very vivid memories of these early times.
I have like a Swiss cheese memory. I don't remember much of my childhood. Everything's kind of glazed over. But I've met other people as well that have these strong memories.
And I've validated those with other people. Like, you know, the people that were there. Just making sure that things were as I was actually recalling them and it wasn't filling in something in my brain.
To me, it's weird, but I understand.
So basically, my mom and dad got married and then they got divorced and then they got remarried and then they had me and then they got divorced again. But things were happening really quickly, and I'm going to use my 51-year-old brain that can look down on things now. For a very long part of my life, I was dealing with the emotions and feelings that I was having with that age of a child's brain, not being able to manage the adult themes that were happening around me. But now I can look down on it and having more life experience and being a mature adult, I can see some of the decisions that were made. So my mom started dating very quickly after divorcing my dad the second time. She remarried within the year to your dad.
She's good in a very dependent relationship.
She is.
I think that although she is a very strong woman, she thrives in a partnership.
Well, the other thing too is that she's a 50s child. So she wanted a stable traditional household. But your dad is not a traditional dude.
No,
so even though, yeah, they're like, I think 9 years apart. And he was more of a 60s child, not a 50s child. Okay. So anyway, very different generationally and also life experiences. But my dad, my biological dad, and my now stepdad did not get along. But I mean, my dad was in night school my whole life. Like, he got his degrees while I was alive.
Education was very important to him. Not saying that education wasn't important to my dad, but it was a different sort of education for my dad.
Well, and that's a really good segue into this. So my stepdad wanted to make sure I was tough. He wanted to make sure that I had life skills and that I was able to manage everything. And, you know, life is harsh, so you got to have these things. Whereas my dad, my biological dad, was more about making sure that I got an education, that I understood etiquette. Biological dad was very formal, and my stepdad was very informal. My mom grew up like my dad.
Yeah, definitely. Much more formal.
Yeah. For example, we would never be eating on a TV tray watching television during dinner at my dad's house. Like, that was a no.
Yeah.
I knew what forks to use where. It led to a lot of confusion and bad co-parenting because my dad, every other weekend, I had one set of rules that I was supposed to live by and a person I was supposed to be. And then when I was with my mom and my stepdad, the rest of the time, I was supposed to be something else. In fact, it was looked down upon that I was too formal or this or that.
Yep.
And then at my dad's, it would look down upon if I was too informal. So as a child, starting at four-ish, a little over four, it was really confusing. And then add to that, and
you are a people pleaser.
I am a people pleaser because that's a codependent cycle that comes from adult children of divorce and also emotionally mature parents.
You love to please everybody. So you were probably like three different people.
I was.
And yourself, who you were for your dad, who you were for our parents, you know.
And then when I was with my grandparents, there were a different set of rules. So imagine you're 4.5 years old and you've got like 5-6 sets of rules and you have to keep them all straight. And then also add to that, the parents and the adults were not behaving great. So, for example, there were times when my grandparents would say bad things about my dad, my biological dad. There were times they would say bad things about my stepdad. So as a child, I'm hearing all of
these
things.
Nobody was good enough for grandma.
Right. Nobody was good enough for grandma. But the thing is that when you're a 4 or 5 year old kid and you can't process those really adult emotions. So I actually became a peacemaker very quickly. Also, my mom and I did have some time of living alone, just her and I. And so
you had mom all to yourself.
I did.
Like, when I was young, she was always working. But yeah. I hear these stories about her like taking you to the zoo and the library and all this fun stuff. And yeah. I'm like, nah, I didn't get any of that.
And I'm focusing on the confusing parts, but there was many, many amazing things in there too. I don't want to give
lots
the impression
of people that loved you.
Yeah. But the problem is that I was also a kid that was pretty sensitive inside. I had a little bit of a hard exterior, but I was a really sensitive kid. And so my feelings often weren't heard or validated by anyone because there was so much drama going on around the adults that, you know, it would build up and build up. And if I tried to explain what I was feeling, it was often shot down. And it's because they were so wrapped up in intentionally wanting to do good things for me, but not actually applying it in a way that was helpful. And so it was not good. And there were moments where I think my stepdad wasn't prepared for the level of defiance that I would bring to the table or questioning.
He talks to me about really liking that mom was a single mom. And that was one of the things that drew him to her because it was a built-in family. Mm-hmm. Because he never really wanted children. So this was a built-in family, and there was already this daughter, and you and him got along well. And
in the beginning, we did.
Yeah.
Before they got married, we did. Before my dad and
Before me.
Well, yes, before you. That's true. But even when they got officially married, the tone of everything changed too. So mom gets pregnant with you and we're all very excited. And I was very excited. And here comes this little baby. And she was the pudgiest, cutest little thing I've ever seen.
They thought I was going to be a boy though. And the due date was actually Valentine's Day, February 14th. But I didn't pop out until March 25th.
Yeah, she stayed
in there.
So
either I was super comfortable or it was the late 70s and they weren't very good at predicting times.
Yeah. So everything changed when you came along. And I know that our listeners out there, some of you can relate to this, that my stepdad absolutely does love me. But there is a difference between, for some people, between your own child and someone else's child. And I was at that point, by the time Stacey was born, I was pretty difficult. We were not getting along. And there were ways that was making my life really uncomfortable. And we weren't communicating very well. And there was yelling and there was screaming and there was things that were happening. And what I would say is that if my mom cried, I would stop the world to stop her from crying from an early age on. And that's also something really common with adult children of divorce.
And all of this happened before I got there.
That's right.
And as a little kid, it's not like they sat me down and said, hey, Stace, here's the history.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I was just kind of going with the flow. And my dad absolutely fell in love with me. He, to this day, would do anything for me. Before we knew my liver was too bad off, he was willing to donate a part of his liver to keep me alive.
Now, to be clear, we all were.
Well, he was a match, though. I mean, he was the most match.
The closest,
he was going to be the one that was going to be.
Right.
And the oldest.
Right.
But he did have a paternal instinct. And I didn't know any different because I just came along and here's my big sister and I love her and she's awesome. And then my mom and dad, and I love them and they're awesome. And then there's this other guy that comes around and hangs out with my sister sometimes and then takes her away. Like, a lot of it was confusing to me as a little kid.
I'm not harboring any resentment at this point, but for many decades of my life, I had to work through that because, unfortunately, I do believe that when you have a child, you're accountable to be decent and to work with each other and to co-parent if necessary. And that was definitely not the case. It wasn't me that was driving a lot of the decision-making.
As adults, they should have rose above.
They should have. But we know more now, too, because divorce was pretty rare at the time. I was only one of two kids in my elementary school.
And by the time I got to middle school, I think my parents were only, like, nobody's parents were still together.
Right. The other thing I want to mention about this is that, so I have wonderful experiences with my sister. I wanted a baby sister. I was responsible for a lot of her care as well, after school, babysitting.
Both everybody worked, you know what I mean? And so Julie was a built-in babysitter.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you take a kid like me who wasn't being validated with her own feelings, hurt, wasn't really developing a sense of self, and then you put me in charge of a job and all I want to do is people please and do everything right. But anyway, you add all that together and it adds conflict and stress. And that got to a fever pitch, to a point where, if I'm quite honest, around 11, where I actually thought the world would be better off if I just wasn't in it. It's the only time that I had suicidal thoughts when I was 11. So
I didn't know that.
I know. So continuing on thinking it, at some point, something had to give. And part of the reason why I stayed from 11 to like 13, almost 14, was because I didn't want to leave my little sister. Because I knew that she wouldn't know any better. She'd just think that I abandoned her.
And I did, to be fair. You know, a little kid has singular thoughts. And
but leaving that situation absolutely saved my life, both figuratively and literally. I will say that I love my mom dearly, and I have love for my stepdad for sure. And I don't question that they do want the best for me now, and that at the time they probably did also. But achieving it was just not working, and it was a very toxic household for me. And I'm not blaming or shaming here. I'm just saying that I think the situation was difficult for everyone. I think everyone was trying to do their best, but I was the collateral damage and I was little. And that went on for a long time. And it got to the point where I had to go.
So she's close to 14. I'm close to 7. And she just vanished from my life. And from what I remember, maybe a handful of times I saw her in the next 7 years. My next real memories of a relationship with my sister was when I was 14, about 7 years later.
You were in high school. And because I had an apartment. I remember.
Was just starting to kind of get to know her. It was interesting and it was weird. And I did have memories of her, but I mean, I remember Mom made a yellow beetle cake for your 16th birthday.
That's right.
And we had a party. I remember visiting your apartment.
Lake of the Woods.
Okay. And you moved from there out of state.
To Baltimore.
And then she was gone again.
Yeah. I had sort of a disproportionate idea of what a big sister should be because I missed all this time, you know? And I think
we didn't grow together.
We didn't. And I had a lot of shame and guilt about leaving her and not building on that relationship because, you know, I loved her and I took care of her. I was one of her caretakers when she was baby on to when I left. And so it was a really hard decision to go. And the background then, every time we would interact after that, would be this thing in my brain subconsciously or sometimes consciously wanting to overcome that shame and guilt. And the worst part is that my idea of what a big sister should be was not what would be a good big sister to Stacy. It was everything I had read or watched in TV or whatever.
Because we didn't really know each other anymore.
Right. So here I show up with this sort of conditioning that's not real. It's media and TV.
And in my head, the furthest thing was I thinking shame. That was nowhere near in my head. I didn't know the heaviness, really, of what had gone on. To me, you just found a better solution with your dad. Your dad had a big house, and you got to go to a fancy school, and that is all that I thought. I did not hold it against you in any way like you left me.
Yeah, and
not at all. I just thought, oh, wow, she gets to live in this big house and go to this fancy school now. And
I loved,
you know,
my dad. I did not want to go to that fancy school. I cried for the whole first quarter. I know this is really heavy. We're going to get to the lighter side as we do, but this is hard to say. I would have left at 11 if it hadn't been not for wanting to leave you.
Yeah.
I went 3 years in a really tough for me situation.
And I feel guilt over that.
No. Making that choice, I only left when it was really obvious it was going to be life or death for me. And by the way, my mom has always loved me. Bruce has always loved me. It's just that we were not getting along in an increasingly more extreme and toxic way. And it was getting worse and worse. So fast forward to here I am. She's back in my life. I'm so excited. I don't want to mess it up again.
And by this point, you know, a little bit of background. I also went to an all-girls school. I had gone to public school until high school. And then my grandmother thought it was going to be great for me. She was very religious. And in a way, it offered me an opportunity to be in an environment where I felt more comfortable being myself. There were boys around. I wasn't judged for what I wore because
and
I didn't have
community. That's what I got from it.
Fanciest clothes. You know, I found musical theater and I found art, and that's where I really thrived. I was fairly quiet. I got good grades. I had a job at a pizza joint. I had a steady boyfriend, and it was a normal high school experience. And I really gained a lot of confidence going into the Catholic high school system.
My dad was good for me from a structure perspective. I needed that kind of structure. And also, at the same time, he was really harsh. It's like, oh, you get a 98? Well, that could have been 100. Took me a long time to learn to strive for excellence, not perfection, and that was totally okay. I would get upset if I found the best way to do something and somebody did it differently, then it would be like, well, but why aren't you doing it this way? It was hard to reconcile. And it wasn't easy, the move to my dad's, because it was one extreme environment to a completely different one. I think that played into the way that I approached you when we did get back together as well. As my point is that now I've spent 4 years cultivating in this different environment where it's pressurized to perform.
So let's fast forward to a point where I was actually receptive to our relationship.
Yeah.
And that was when I turned 21. Mm-hmm. And I had gotten out of an engagement, and I decided to move to where my big sister was in Baltimore. So we left actually from the bar of my 21st birthday, where my grandparents bought me shots. And I passed out in one state and woke up in another, driving the whole way.
Packed the car and took her up there. And then B being like, thinking I'm going to be a good big sister. I've got a job waiting for her, a place to live waiting for her. You know, all these things that I thought I was supposed to do. And I made a lot of mistakes because I didn't know her. So the people I was putting her with weren't really the people to put her with. And the place for her to work probably wasn't the place for her to work. But I was thinking I had these jobs to do as a big sister, and I was going to do them, and it was going to be great. And I was going to provide for her as a big sister, and I was going to do all this stuff.
So I was receptive to a relationship with you. But I was also out on my own for the first time.
Yeah.
And I felt very independent, away from mom and dad, and I really wanted to be my own person.
But I was teaching high school, so I've always been teachery.
Yes,
even when we were little and we were living together.
Oh, yeah. We used to play school.
Yeah. And I was always a teacher. So I don't know. I always loved, I felt called to do it. It was, I still feel like it's a calling. It's not
You're good at it.
Well, it also explains why I can very easily, at 35 years in now, especially when I'm talking about something I feel really passionate about.
It's difficult for me to explain things like you do. You're very good at breaking things down and making them relatable, especially, you know, like sciences. Those are hard things.
Yeah, but sometimes I'm learning and have been for a while learning that people don't want that. They just want to listen or
take the compliment.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm giving you the vase and the flowers. Just water them.
I know. But I was teaching high school and I became the drama sponsor, which we put on 6 productions a year. So I asked Stacy to join me.
Because of my musical theater background.
Right,
and
to
I
be
did
a co-sponsor.
Community theater. Like I had dreams that I would be on Broadway one day. It did not happen. But I loved the stage and all aspects, directing, behind the scenes, acting, singing, dancing. I love everything about live theater.
So I was teaching biology during the day, and I was teaching in something called an alternative learning program with students that were spending some of their day at a juvenile delinquent center and coming in. I was spending the second half of my day teaching honors and AP students because, you know,
we were in Baltimore
overachiever.
City. Yeah, you were.
Well, but yeah, so then we got together in a big way. And, you know, of course, because we don't do simple things, we're going to work together and we're going to do productions, which
are
hard.
Get to know each other.
Yeah.
I look back on that time very joyfully, actually.
Yeah, I do too.
I know we butt heads on things, but it felt like we were doing it together.
We were.
And I loved that teamwork. And, you know, if I'm honest, I do feel like it laid the foundation for how good our relationship is now.
Yeah, we're
still going to stumble a little in between then and now.
We had to work through conflict. And the other thing, too, is if anybody that's listening has ever been part of a high school drama club or high school dramatic events that's being put on, it's all the dopamine. It's all the serotonin, and they're performing and you're helping them. And it's like really fills your cup up.
I still think back. We were in the car. I'm going to sidetrack for a second. We were in the car yesterday driving, and Our House by Madness came on.
Yeah.
And I just started singing along and having fun. And I started thinking, there are a big group of kids now that are only about 5 years younger than me that hear that song and to this day still think of me and you.
Yeah.
Miss Stacy, Miss Johns.
Teaching high school is so rewarding. I mean, teaching is rewarding to me, but I mean, high school, you have to love it, you know, but it's such a formative time. So it was really the parallel between us formatively, really for the first time as adults, getting to each other around a whole bunch of young adults that were getting to know themselves too. I think there was something happening there where like they're authentically figuring out who they are and they're going through all the trials and tribulations. And we were doing that too in real time. And they saw some of that. They saw some of that drama.
Yeah, they did. So it was a solid 4 years.
Yeah.
Right. We had, you know, we went through a whole class and we had those 4 years of building foundations to our relationship as adults. Mm-hmm. And then we stumbled again.
We did.
We did. We'll just say this stumble was my fault. I'm not going to go into details, but I definitely created a riff. I will say a little bit was your fault for encouraging me when deep down inside you weren't comfortable with the situation I had put myself in. But you encouraged it, which led me to believe that you were comfortable. And this led to a whole year of us not talking.
Yeah. And so I lived in the Annapolis, Baltimore area for a little tiny bit over 10 years. But she came to me when I had already been there for about 6 of those years or something. Mm-hmm. So then I left and came back to Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where we are now and where we're both from. I came back to go back to graduate school and I had a partner here. Yeah, I had a partner here. And so there was that. I will say that I think our lack of communication during that time did really contribute to how long it took us to get back to each other again.
I think that I had gotten used to you in my life, but I still wasn't the best at communicating, and I still had a bit of a chip on my shoulder. Had something like this happened now, I probably would have spoke up for myself. But you had called me at one point, and this was right towards the end before we didn't speak again, and you called me and you said, don't talk. I'm going to say everything I need to say.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I think in hindsight, if we were now, or if, not even just we, if I was who I was, I would have stopped you. I would have tried to communicate. I would have tried to make it better. Yeah. But instead, I just shut up.
Yeah.
I let you say everything you needed. And then again, you're just gone.
Well, and the other thing I was really referring to was you were saying that by me encouraging you to do these things, you assumed that was like my approval for something, let's say. And that was never, ever my intention. And so that's what I meant by communicating clearly. And I don't think I had the skills at the time to do that. And I also don't think I recognized everything either. You know, we got to have grace for ourselves looking back at things. It's funny. Like
I created this riff,
but talking about it, I'm thinking about how many riffs have we had to come back to each other. This is the first time that I think you and I have really sat down, and we're doing it live, right?
Yes.
Or recording, but sat down and talked about how many, there's quite a few. And so then I come back to Cincinnati and she stays.
I stayed. I was in college. I was bartending. That first job that Julie referenced was a bartending job.
Yeah.
I'm not going to blame it on her. But
I was a bartender at the time, and it was a way to make money, and it's expensive to live there.
It is expensive.
And we're both extroverted, and I knew she would make good money.
You know, it sounded cool. It sounded glamorous, you know, and I was in a big city. Okay, cool. The money was great, and it was really easy, I should say. That is where I got my first real taste of alcohol. I had never drank in a bar before my 21st birthday, but I really wasn't a drinker. I was a pretty good girl. And that first bartending job, they encouraged what they call a shift drink. And it is, you get there to work, you clock in, you make yourself a drink. If you loosen up, you're going to be friendlier to the customers. The customers are going to loosen up and spend more money. And then if someone wants to buy you a shot, that's great. The bar makes money. You get to have the shot as long as you cannot get, you know, sloppy drunk. And then they're drinking more too.
For me, when I was bartending in the places I did, you got your shift drunk at the end of your shift. It was never, you weren't encouraged
throughout. But this was my first bartending job. Mm-hmm. And this did lay some foundations.
Sure.
So Julie moves. And I stay. I was going to school at Towson University, electronic medium film, EMF major. I started working for a radio station. I loved it. I have always been very driven by music and art. And this was all that I wanted and more with producing and promotions. And I loved it. And I went to about a billion live concerts. And I saw every band I pretty much ever wanted to see. And life was pretty easy and carefree. I had a steady partner. We dated for 17 years. So yeah, we had our struggles, but things just always seemed to work out. And being so far away from my family, Julie, my parents, and he didn't really have close family there, it became just me and him against the world. He wasn't a drinker. And on our very first date, I brought a bottle of 99 bananas over to his house. It's 99 proof liquor. It tastes disgusting. And they have different flavors, bananas, peach, grape. And so I brought over 99 bananas. And
thus was born the beginning of codependency.
I made him a drinker. I did.
Yeah, and in addition to the things that Stacy and I were going through, I had some pretty rough things happen to me as well. I was attacked at one point, and that took me into kind of a bad spot. So I think that even if I had really had the inclination to get the right tools for us to build our sister relationship better, I wasn't in a place to do it. Coming back here, I love Maryland. I would move back there tomorrow. My experience there
is vastly different from mine.
Right.
She lived in a very pretty place.
Well, I haven't. My dad's sister, my aunt, lived there.
And Annapolis is very pretty and safe. It's beautiful. And
yeah, it was great.
Has a different kind of vibe and lifestyle than Baltimore City, yeah, which is where I live. Tell me more about your life then. Like, in Cincinnati. What were you doing? Yeah.
So I had gone back to graduate school. I was one of the older ones. I always chose the hard things. So I really love.
That's a metaphor for you.
I really love what I do. But when I was in Baltimore, I was working with, when I got my undergrad, I was working with a foremost spider expert doing behavior work.
Gross.
It was so awesome. And so I was really, I think I was working my way up, and I was working with a person who was really good, and she has since passed away. Nancy Kreider was the most amazing mentor ever, but she was encouraging me to go back to school. So I went to work at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research for a year to one of the foremost spider experts in the world, and got to do and continue working on behavior. The goal was to teach college, which I ended up doing. So
woo-woo, Professor Julie.
So yeah, I got my dream job, and then my personal life imploded.
Oh, well, but can't have it all, right?
Can't have it all. Well, yeah. So my partner of almost 9 years or so, at that point, we got together for the second time. You know, we split up and I went off and bought my own house and was doing this like whole Miss Independent thing, hoping that Stacy and I would start building a relationship. And so we tentatively started a little bit of that.
Sort of. When we moved back here, Mom and Dad said, come live with us. And you can save up money for a house, because why throw your money away in an apartment if you can, you know, save up and put a down payment on a house? Anyway, so we're living with my parents. Obviously, we were drinking and sometimes heavy, but it was not that we were hiding our drinking. We were just very good at not overindulging.
I'm going to call you out. You were absolutely hiding your drinking, because
we weren't.
Here's the thing. You weren't hiding that you were drinking, and you were always very upfront about that.
Yeah, I didn't pass out or fall down.
I don't think that the volume was something that anybody understood at that time. I don't. I think that
Dad did the recycling. He would see the cans that were taken out. And yes, we would drink a handle of vodka, and we wouldn't always put that in that trash.
Okay.
Sometimes we'd take it
in
a book bag or something.
Okay, so that doesn't sound like upfront behavior. That sounds like
they saw us. They walked past the room. They saw the shot glasses.
I know
they saw the bottle.
I know they saw the shot glasses and the bottle, but that doesn't mean that they knew how much.
Observing my behavior, and by that point, I had a very high tolerance. So our volume of drinking probably was fairly high.
I was concerned at that point.
But it wasn't. I wasn't drunk.
Whether I should have been concerned or not, I was concerned at that point.
It wasn't until we were close to moving out and then buying our own house, having us by ourselves, is where things escalated drinking-wise.
And that makes sense, because you don't have any watchful eyes. You can
do- No, and things did change for me and Ryan's drinking at that point. And
did it escalate quickly or was it slow?
You know, it's
volume, I mean.
Right. It's interesting that you ask this, because and I don't know if you can relate in a similar situation, not necessarily with drinking, but we'll see if this makes sense. You know how you can do something steady or do something every day or do something enough that it becomes a habit?
Sure.
And then all of a sudden you're really deep into something and you don't exactly know how you got there.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe I get home from work at 5 and he gets home at 5:30 and we take a shot. And then we go about doing stuff, and then we have dinner, and I take another couple shots or something like that. But then fast forward a couple months, and I've come home at 5, and I take 2 shots.
Yeah.
And then he comes home, and we take 2 shots.
And this level of drinking, though, even though you had high tolerance, and I get that, but at this level of drinking, your memory is going to be altered. Because, you know, did I take that shot? Did I not take that shot? Oh, well, let's do another one.
We had a piece of paper and we would do stick lines.
Okay.
And then we would count.
Yeah.
So anyway, my drinking escalated.
What year did you come back?
2012, October.
And you got your liver 4 years ago. So
2021.
2021. Okay. Would you say you were an alcoholic in 2012?
By normal standards? Yeah, maybe.
Would you say that you were an alcoholic before you moved home by those same standards?
Yeah, maybe then.
Before you came home. Okay. I was just trying to get, you know, an idea of, for our listeners, a timeline. Yeah. And I moved back in 2003, I want to say.
I lived in Baltimore 12 and a half years.
And when did you get your house?
We got our house in 2015.
So 3 years with mom and dad, and then you got your house in 20...
No, it must have been 14.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah. So, okay, 2014. All right. So 2 years with mom and dad.
We lived with them about 2.5 years.
So it took about just 2 years of that level of drinking?
Yeah. I drank at home. I drank with my partner. I was very careful not to lose that bit of control that I needed. I was thinking of putting this up on the website.
Yeah, a timeline.
But you had started this by saying who we are. Who I am now. It's so cliche. When you almost die, casket shopping, you've got 2 weeks to live, hospice, everything changes. Everything changes. My wants and drives are so much less selfish, so much less concerned with myself. I was very me-driven. And I didn't consider it necessarily selfish. I was just very focused on me. Me, 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 and what I did and what I wanted. And I wasn't like rude or inconsiderate to others. At least I didn't think so. But I stand up for myself more. Mm-hmm. And that's why I said in that conversation when you called me, had I been more like myself now, I would have said, no, we can work through this.
Yeah.
No, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
So I stand up for myself more. I'm still a very blunt person. I mean, I
think we're both direct and
tell it like it is.
Yeah.
Or how I see it. But I'm so much more kind. I'm so much more with an open heart and an open mind. And lastly, I'm very much less of a hermit.
Drinking
made me just want to stay home. I never drunk drove. I never, you know, did any of that. Drank in a bar to where I was too drunk. No, I would have, you know, happy hour and then I would go home and do my drinking.
Yeah. And who I am now, I'm 51, going to be 52. And for the first time in my life, I think I'm showing up for myself authentically.
I love it.
It has been a long and hard road. I had to, first of all, figure out what the conditioning was that I was running off of going all the way back and working through all that. It has been a long road. I made a lot of really poor personal choices. I made better choices in my career. So I am an analytical person. I'm not a linear thinker. I'm more of an abstract thinker. I don't want to give up until I know I can be successful.
You'll find a way.
Yeah, I'm going to find a way. But I'm going to find a way because I don't want to fail. The fear of failure is really big with me.
It matters how you get back up. That's what I tell myself.
And I know that failure is opportunity now, but at the time it was like, ugh, tantamount to death.
That pressure on yourself.
Oh, so much.
And that was placed there.
It was encouraged and reinforced, I think. And then it's interesting when you become your own abuser, which is what I've done in my life.
Eesh, I don't like that phrasing.
No, it's true, because what I started doing to myself was already hurting me. And I did that because that's what I knew. That's what felt right. And so you always lean back in. I didn't notice the patterns I was enacting over and over again. So maybe this time it will be different. But anyways, in terms of my career, I'm a tenured professor. I worked really hard for that. And I had some leadership roles that I was really proud of that I've since resigned or stepped down from.
I just got married in October.
You did?
Woo-hoo!
That's right.
Actually, I got married to my first boyfriend that I dated in high school.
And another person that didn't like me. Maybe now we're
You know, he very much appreciates you. The biggest reason he loves you the most is because you helped keep me alive so that we could get to this point 25 years apart from each other to finally get married.
I really like him.
You can name him Brett. Brett.
I like him for you. I like him as a human. He's a genuinely good human. He leads with a kindness that's like, he's like a genuinely,
He sees a house on fire or a car on fire. He runs towards it to make sure that all the pets, animals, and people are out.
Like, that's right. And I'm not saying he's perfect because none of us are, but I do think he's perfect for you. And I think at the time, I was still in that big sister space where I wanted to be like the good big sister. And I wanted to warn you, is this really what you want to do?
Yeah, well, I was 18 and you were right. And we broke up and I went to college. This harps back to communication.
Yeah.
There were a lot of assumptions made both on his part and mine. And, you know, I was just like, well, my sister says I shouldn't be in a committed relationship at 18, that I should not get ready to get married. And my friend says this. And it was the best thing for both of us, honestly.
I think who you are now is even a better fit than what you were then.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And I realize that, you know,
Yeah, that's he's just amazing. One opinion. And I love him.
So I am really actively working to get back to me on trying to live the last third of my life by showing up for myself authentically. And that means doing the really hard work. It also means having some grace for myself when I backtrack by accident or when I do something that, you know.
She's so hard on herself and she can't take a compliment for anything.
I'm working on that.
We love to travel.
We do. We love adventures.
We take a sister trip every year, just the two of us.
Yeah.
And try to just really like continue to cultivate this relationship. I think this podcast definitely does that as well. I was really nervous to talk about our history. Yeah, I really was.
I want to say also that you were talking about how your life changed because you almost lost your life.
Oh, yeah.
Well, my life changed because I almost lost you. And there was a lot of other things going on at the same time. But you definitely...
A lot of people have told me I'm a different person.
You come out on the other side and all of a sudden there is a little clarity there about what's important and what isn't.
For sure.
You know, and I know that people say that and that's really cliche.
That's exactly it. I don't have... Well, technically I don't have a lot of time because of my organ. But I mean, I really don't have all the time in the world to hold grudges. I don't have the time to sweat. The small stuff, I guess you could call it. I don't have the time. I don't have the bandwidth. I don't have the energy. Yeah. I have much more important things that I'm interested in doing and saying and loving.
Yeah.
And I am on fantastic terms with our parents.
Yeah.
I'm on fantastic terms with you. I think you are in a much better place with my dad, you know, than you ever were. I want to say this is probably the best place you've been while I've been alive.
That's true. Our relationship as sisters, too.
It's important to me.
It's very important to me. I love you very much. But I think that maybe part of the reason why I was able to not take things personally, we're going to get to this when we start talking about in other episodes when we talk about specific events, but to not take something personally, because keep the bigger picture in mind, because it was so obvious to me how terminal this was and how scary this was. I didn't want to waste a single moment being defensive or upset around something that I know we could either work out later or it wouldn't matter, because we didn't have time for all that.
So I think we did good in giving a little bit of history.
Yeah. And I think that us just doing this, trying to reach a community and talk to people, shows our commitment to each other. Whatever time we have left together, we want to make it count. And that means sharing our story. That means saying some hard stuff. And that also means wanting to dive into experiences together because we can.
And for sure, healing from all these, talking it out. It does give me a bit of introspection when you've used that phrase, looking back with an adult mind on things. Some of these stories I haven't really thought about in a very long time because either I felt ashamed or hurt or it was just too much. And so looking back now at different things, I feel a little bit more at peace with our history.
I do too. I think I have felt and maybe still a little bit feel oftentimes misunderstood, but a lot less so now. I think you actually see me now.
Oh, yeah.
Or you show up with the intention of seeing me, whereas before we were so closed off to each other. There was so much defensiveness and armor up and protection that it was hard to get through all of that. And we did anyway, though. I graduated from college and I took my sister to the Bahamas and like, you know, that was the person I wanted to take. And it was a fun story.
That was a fun trip. Mm-hmm.
But it does help to explain a little bit about how we're showing up for each other now and even in this podcast.
Yeah.
We're telling our story, which is very personal. It's between us. And although we're going to talk about, like, I'm going to talk about technical stuff, I'm going to bring up some biology things, it isn't necessarily ever going to be a one size fits all for anybody. Mm-mm. And no matter what we say, we had to put a lot of work into this to be us right now. It was a commitment on both of our sides to have grace and love for each other and show up for each other this way. I don't think that's automatic. And there may be people listening that don't have that person yet or don't have that person with the same continuity that we have it for each other.
Maybe you can take comfort in us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's what I was getting at. Maybe we can help.
I think for me, the healing part of it is I wasn't sure if I was ever going to be able to say some of these things to you that you're hearing me say. And it feels really validating.
We're using our therapy words. I'm receiving you. Sorry.
Well, I use the word validation because I'm trying to build my own self-worth. And one of the things about me is I don't often feel seen or validated.
Wish you could see you through all of our eyes.
But when it comes to biology stuff, I feel real confident. So I come off real confident about that.
Yeah, you do.
All right. Well, listen, it's been really good. And I'm appreciative of this. And this will hopefully help all of you get to know us a little bit better.
Thanks for joining us and getting to know us a little bit better. And I hope this kind of fills in some of the blanks.
All right. Well, with that, this is Life Expectancy. And we're sisters that are surviving. And today we're definitely thriving.
Yeah.
And we hope that you're working to the same.
Bye.
Bye.
Before you go, don't forget to visit life-expectancy.com to become a free member of our growing community. You'll get updates, extras, and soon a place to connect with others walking similar paths. Music for Life Expectancy is composed by the talented Ryan Brunn. And a heartfelt thank you to our producer, Kinsey, for making each episode possible. And if you're looking for something to carry you between the episodes, check out our Spotify playlist, Life Expectancy Podcast Season 1. It's public, curated with care, and linked on our site along with all of our socials. Thank you for being a part of this journey with us.